Hello, listeners, and welcome to Iris and the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, August 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a quick look at the weather forecast for today. Our trend toward warmer temperatures continues, though latest indications are that we may not get as hot as initially projected. A chance of storms is on track for tonight as a strong warm front moves toward eastern Iowa. The warm front's position will be key in determining tomorrow's highs, with mid-90s for Waterloo, Cedar Rapids, and Iowa City. Northeast of this line, you'll be cooler. To the southwest, upper 90s may occur. On Wednesday, a cold front will move south through eastern Iowa, which is about 24 to 36 hours faster than initially projected. This should work to cut the heat down to the mid to upper 80s. Hotter temperatures may return again by Saturday. The stories on the front page today include Waverly's Red Fox may open this year, Democrats delay primary decision, and let's begin reading Back to the Ballot Box. Majority of Iowans who regained rights voted in 2020. This story filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau and opens with a photograph of Eric Harris as he poses for a portrait on Friday at his home in Iowa City. Dateline Des Moines. It had been roughly two decades since he was allowed to vote, and Eric Harris felt it was important that he cast a ballot again. The Iowa City man, now in his 40s, lost his right to vote in Iowa when he was convicted of three felony offenses between 1998 and 2014. He gained it in 2020 when Governor Kim Reynolds issued an executive order that automatically reinstated the right to vote of Iowans like Harris, who had been convicted of felonies but completed their sentences. So Harris, his rights restored, voted in the 2020 election. Quote, I spent almost 20 years not being able to vote because of felony convictions, Harris said. Quote, I just wanted to vote, and I was able to vote, and it was an important vote. The 2020 vote was a very important vote, unquote. Before Reynolds's executive order, Iowans who had been convicted of felonies were required to individually petition the governor to restore their voting rights. At the time, Iowa was the only state with a requirement that restrictive. After Reynolds issued her executive order, 3,955 Iowans who had previously been made ineligible to vote due to felony convictions re-registered to vote before that year's November election, according to data from the State Elections Office. Of those 3,955 newly registered voters, 3,041, which is 77%, or nearly 4 out of every 5 who re-registered, followed through and voted in the 2020 general election, according to the state data. The state data covers only those Iowans who had the right to vote, lost it upon conviction, and then re-registered to vote after having that right restored by Reynolds's executive order. A spokesman said the state elections office does not have broader data on how many Iowans became eligible to vote with the executive order, even if they had not registered before, constraining the ability to determine what percentage of all Iowans who became newly eligible to register under the executive order. Various reports in 2020, including one from the issue advocacy group, the Sentencing Project, estimated Reynolds' executive order has restored the voting rights of 35,000 to 45,000 Iowans. Harris believes so strongly that Iowans convicted of felonies should have the right to vote and should exercise that right that he has spent the past 3 years plus encouraging others to register and vote. Quote, people right now, with things that are going on in the country right now, people might not be happy, Harris said. But when I was able to vote in 2020, that was important to me, unquote. When Reynolds issued the executive order, she called it a matter of second chances and acknowledged inequalities in the justice system. Quote, the right to vote is the cornerstone of society and the free republic in which we live. When someone serves their sentence, they should have their right to vote restored automatically, Reynolds said in a statement accompanying her executive order. The journey to that executive order, however, started on a different path. Reynolds originally called for state lawmakers to propose an amendment to the Iowa Constitution that would state Iowans convicted of a felony would regain the right to vote upon completion of their sentences. Reynolds favored the constitutional amendment because it is a more permanent solution. Executive orders, in contrast, can be undone by the next governor. That's exactly what has happened with the issue of voting rights for Iowans convicted of felonies. Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack, in 2005, issued an executive order automatically reinstating the voting rights of Iowans who have completed their sentences for felony convictions. But in 2011, Republican Governor Terry Branstad issued his own executive order, which required Iowans who have completed their sentences for felony convictions to individually petition the governor to have their voting rights restored. But while a constitutional amendment was Reynolds's preferred path, proposals bogged down in the legislature, which is controlled by her fellow Republicans. In particular, Republicans in the Senate could not agree on what requirements should be added before a convicted voter had his or her rights restored. After failed attempts in the 2019 and 2020 legislative sessions, Reynolds resorted to the executive order just before the 2020 general election. Reynolds said at the time that she would continue to advocate for a constitutional amendment, but the issue received little to no discussion from the majority agenda-setting Republicans in the 2021 or 2022 legislative sessions. Republican State House leaders said Reynolds's executive order removed the urgency from the issue. As to the proportionately low number of Iowans who re-registered and voted in 2020 after having that right restored, Harris said there can be many hurdles to persuading that population to vote again, including a distrust in government institutions. Harris also said he believes the state could do more to inform and educate those Iowans about their restored voting rights, especially by meeting those Iowans where they are at community events. The bottom line for Harris, and why he also supports a more permanent solution, is that voting rights should be automatically granted to those who have completed their sentences. He said that right should not be left to the whims of only the governor. Quote, if, Harris said, you live in this community and pay taxes, and you paid your debt to society, you should be able to vote. That's it. Unquote. Our next story comes from the Associated Press. The journalist is Will Weissert. Democrats delay primary order decision until after the 2022 vote. Dateline Washington. The Democratic Party on Saturday delayed a decision on potentially reordering its primary calendar for the 2024 presidential election until after November's midterm elections. The Democratic National Committee's Rules Committee had planned to decide during meetings in Washington beginning this week whether to recommend that presidential voting should continue to begin with Iowa and New Hampshire. That's amid calls by some party leaders and activists that more diverse states, including the current number 3 and number 4, Nevada and South Carolina, should move up. The committee was also mulling adding a fifth early primary contest prior to Super Tuesday, when a large number of states traditionally vote. But Rules Committee co-chairs Jim Roosevelt Jr. and Minion Moore wrote in a memo to members that, quote, after speaking with many of you over the past several weeks about the last few steps of this process, it has become clear that the best way to move forward with the final stage of this process is to postpone the committee's decision on the pre-window rule until after the midterm elections, unquote. The committee will still meet beginning Friday, but now doesn't plan to make a decision until after Election Day, November 8, meaning that the primary calendar decision won't affect key congressional races. Iowa and New Hampshire had argued that possibly losing their positions going first and second could hurt Democrats in the state's top races, especially since the Republican Party has already said Iowa will continue to lead off its 2024 primaries. Quote, following the midterm elections, we will reconvene to update our evaluation of the applicant pool and work towards a final decision to present the full DNC for a vote, which DNC leadership has assured us they will make happen as soon as the midterm elections as is possible. Roosevelt and Moore wrote, adding that we will continue to work with the applicants in the coming weeks to hammer out final details, unquote. 16 states and Puerto Rico made presentations before the committee to be first, or at least in the top five, before the Rules Committee earlier this summer. The party is considering factors like diversity, electoral competitiveness, and logistical feasibility in making its decision. That means scrutinizing states' racial and ethnic makeup, union membership rates, and how big they are in terms of population and geography can affect possibilities for direct voter engagement and the costs of travel and advertising. The next story was written by The Courier's Andy Malone. Construction of Waverly's Red Fox Hotel and Event Center makes progress. And the story opens up with a photograph of the exterior of the motel, and you can see snow fence surrounding part of the building and a big red fox head as part of the sign for the facility. Dateline Waverly. Locals have referred to the 1900 Heritage Way as the Red Fox for years, and the redeveloper of Waverly's former Red Fox Inn confirmed Thursday they can continue to do so. Quote, we were going to rename it, but came to the conclusion everyone out there calls it the Red Fox, said Nick Graham of 1859 Ventures, LLC. Quote, we kept it for brand recognition, pointing out the Highlander Hotel in Iowa City did something similar. The former inn had been derelict for years and was acquired by the city of Waverly in 2020 after property taxes went unpaid. The city council selected 1859 Ventures' $3.5 million redevelopment proposal over competing pitches. Graham is highly confident the newly rehabilitated and upscale Red Fox Hotel and Event Center will open its doors by the end of this year, the deadline stated in a development agreement with the city. He is accepting bookings for the new event center beginning in February of 2023. The agreement states the total property value must increase to $5 million by January 2023. The hotel will have 54 units, Graham said. He has a personal goal of reopening in September, but a lot would have to fall the right way in order to make that happen. Quote, doors, for instance. I don't know when these are going to show up, Graham said. But all that considered, there have not been too many scheduling delays, unquote. Additionally, the project already brought 34 market-rate rental units to the former inn. More about the project can be found on Facebook by searching Red Fox Inn Reconstruction. Due to inflationary pressures and unforeseen surprises that come with any construction project, Graham said the projected cost is now about 30% more than the original estimate. In turn, the council approved an amendment to the original development agreement in May, increasing the incremental property tax rebates to reflect the substantial cost uptick. Graham gave examples to the council from, quote, doing the plumbing right and electronics to procuring heating and cooling equipment for convention center and the addition of sprinklers to all hotel rooms as reasons for requesting the amendment. Quote, there's just been a lot of items where I've really tried to go the extra mile to make this an impeccable grade A development, Graham said. The 6 years of rebates, beginning with the fiscal year 2023-24, are only applied to the increase in property taxes as a result of the increase in commercial and residential property value, not what ends up being the total value after the improvements are made. Originally, the rebates were on a sliding scale. 100% of the additional taxes in years 1 and 2, and then 80%, 60%, 40% and 20% the following years. The amendment made it 100% all 6 years. The projected abatement over the 6 years went from $332,000 to $499,000, but there is a cap on the actual abatement of $500,000. A job requirement also was slashed in May. The developer said the requirement made it more difficult to secure financing because of the uncertainty. The next story is titled, DC League of Super Pets Tops at the Box Office. The story was written by Lindsay Barr, the Associated Press film writer, and it begins with a still from the film, which is captioned, "This image released by Warner Brothers Pictures shows Crypto, voiced by Dwayne Johnson, in a scene from DC League of Super Pets." And we see a white dog with a gold Superman kind of symbol and a red cape. The summer box office showed signs of slowing down this weekend as the animated DC League of Super Pets opened in theaters across North America. The superhero spinoff about Superman's dog earned $23 million from 4,314 locations, according to studio estimates on Sunday. Though slightly less than expected, it was still enough to capture the first place spot and knock Jordan Peele's Nope into second place in its second weekend. Analysts had pegged DC League of Super Pets for a $25 million launch, which was on the lower end for animated openings this summer. In June, the $50.6 million for Lightyear was considered underwhelming for the $200 million Disney Pixar movie. Then, in early July, Universal's Minions, The Rise of Gru, captured $107 million in its first 3 days. But Super Pets is more comparable to Universal's The Bad Guys, which netted out with around $97 million domestic after a $23 million opening, and it's much, much stronger than Paramount's Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hanks, $6.3 million debut several weeks ago. Quote, "This opening is a huge win for DC fans, the box office, Warner Brothers, and our filmmakers," said Jeff Goldstein, the studio's president of domestic distribution. Quote, "DC League of Super Pets was not intended to be a midsummer release. Originally, Super Pets had been slated for May, while this weekend was reserved for Black Adam, Warner Brothers' other Dwayne Johnson superhero pick. But post-production delays due to a backup at VFX houses forced Black Adam to move back to October. Instead of giving up the prime date, the studio filled the open spot with a family-friendly title with an all-star voice cast, including Kevin Hart, John Krasinski, Keanu Reeves, and Kate McKinnon as an evil guinea pig. Quote, Super Pets has several summer vacation weeks left with little significant competition, and the hope is that it will continue to grow steadily thanks to positive feedback from audiences this weekend. Quote, the interest is red hot, Goldstein said. Word of mouth is exceptional. Second place went to Universal's Nope, which fell 57% from its debut last weekend and earned an additional $18.6 million. The North American grosses for Nope are now sitting at $80.6 million before it begins its international expansion in August. Thor: Love and Thunder took third place with $13.1 million in its fourth weekend, bringing its domestic total to $301.5 million. Its global total is now sitting at $662 million, without a release in China. Minions: The Rise of Gru stuck its heels in fourth place in the fifth weekend with $10.9 million. Worldwide, it has now earned $710.4 million. And rounding out the top five was Top Gun: Maverick, which made an additional $8.2 million in its 10th weekend, bringing its domestic total to $650.1 million. New theatrical releases were limited this weekend. Focus Features debuted the film Vengeance in 998 locations this weekend, where it earned an estimated $1.8 million. BJ Novak's directional debut follows a podcaster, Novak, who travels from New York to West Texas to investigate the death of his girlfriend. The well-reviewed thriller features Issa Rae and Ashton Kutcher. And Bleecker Street opened with Sundance Charmer, A Love Song, starring Wes Studi and Dale Dickey in 4 theaters, where it earned an estimated $18,702. And now we turn the page to the Northeast Iowa Area Escapades. This is a regular Monday feature of the Courier. Here are just a few of the events, shenanigans, and goings-on worth checking out this week in the Northeast Iowa area. On Tuesday, August 2nd, Block Party series continues with Heartsmith. The Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center continues its Block Party series at Greenbrier with Heartsmith on Tuesday. The free outdoor concert begins at 7 p.m. at 1554 Oakwood Drive in Waterloo. Don't forget a blanket or a lawn chair for comfort. Also on Tuesday, Metropolitan Brass to perform. August ensembles presented by the Cedar Falls Municipal Band begin Tuesday in Overman Park in downtown Cedar Falls. Metropolitan Brass will perform beginning at 7 p.m. in the band's shell. Admission is free. Bring a lawn chair or blanket and perhaps a picnic supper and settle in on the lawn. On the next day, Wednesday, August 3rd, time to park at the fair at NCC. Restoring classic cars or maintaining muscle cars is a favorite American hobby. Now it's time to polish up that chrome and let others admire your hard work at the park at fair on the National Cattle Congress grounds in Waterloo. The show and shine begins at 4 p.m. on the National Cattle Congress grounds in Waterloo. Then on Thursday, we have Bob Doerr and Friends for live music. Bob Doerr gets by with a little help from his friends, and they'll join the local legend for live music Thursday on River Place Plaza, 100 East 2nd Street in Cedar Falls. The tunes begin at 5 p.m., and admission is free. Food will be available for purchase from Carter House and beverages from Eagle View Hospitality. Also on Thursday, Seussical the Musical at Oster Regent. Cat in the Hat will lead audiences through stories about Horton the Elephant, Gertrude McFuzz, and Jojo, a little boy with a big imagination, in Seussical the Musical. Performances are at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Oster Regent Theater, 103 Main Street, in downtown Waterloo. The musical is presented by the Cedar Falls Community Theater. For tickets, visit osterregent.com at the Oster Regent box office or by calling area code 319-277-5283. And also on Thursday, Battle of Bands heralds Irish Fest. On Thursday at 6:30 p.m., the Battle of the Iowa Irish Bands takes place at Screaming Eagle Bar and Grill, 228 East 4th Street in downtown Waterloo. Bands will get audiences in the groove for the weekend's Iowa Irish Fest. Now, on Friday through Sunday, Iowa Irish Fest is finally here. The 16th annual Iowa Irish Fest celebrates all things Irish: music, arts, culture, sports, food, beverages, and Irish culture in Iowa. The open-air event takes place in the area around Lincoln Park in downtown Waterloo. The Red Hot Chili Pipers, the most famous bagpipe band on the planet, will headline opening night on Friday. The band has performed around the globe and performed sold-out tours in 21 countries. Gaelic Storm returns to the Cedar Valley on Saturday. The band headlined the 2021 Irish Fest. On Sunday, the High Kings will headline. The critically acclaimed band is widely regarded as one of the best Irish folk bands around the world. To purchase tickets and for a complete schedule of events, go to iowairishfest.com. And the last event listed here is for Saturday, August 6th, Summer Jazz series continues. Chris Murs and Mike Conrad will perform jazz at the Black Hawk Hotel, 115 Main Street, Cedar Falls. The jazz musicians, both professors at the University of Northern Iowa School of Music, will perform their set from 7:30 to 10 o'clock p.m. in Bar Winslow. There is no cover charge. And here the Courier lists the festivals of interest. National Balloon Classic Festival is in Indianola through Saturday. Wachir Summer Flea Market is in Wachir on Friday through Sunday. The Iowa State Fair is Des Moines from August 11th to the 21st. Dyke Watermelon Days, August 12th through 14th. The Old Time Power Show, Antique Acres, Cedar Falls, is August 19th through the 21st. Cedar Valley Pride Fest, August 26th through 27th. Artapalooza is in Cedar Falls on September 10th. And National Cattle Congress Fair is September 21st through the 25th. Now we have a story by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Exposed people get first Iowa monkeypox shots. Dateline Des Moines. The state of Iowa has enough monkeypox vaccines to vaccinate 300 people and is prioritizing individuals who have had an exposure to the virus. Department of Human Services spokesperson Alex Carfrae said on Thursday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized an additional 800,000 doses of a vaccine against the virus to be allocated to states and other jurisdictions on Wednesday. The administration has not announced how the doses will be divided among the states, and Carfrae said he does not yet know how many doses the state will receive from the latest batch. Quote, to date, Iowa has accepted every dose allocated to us by the feds, Carfrae said. Like the COVID-19 vaccine, the monkeypox vaccine is delivered in a two-dose series, and Carfrae said the state has 600 doses on hand. Monkeypox is a rare disease caused by a virus which is in the same family as the smallpox virus, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Symptoms include fever, headache, muscle aches, and a rash. The disease is rarely fatal. The current outbreak of the virus has been declared a public health emergency of international concern. The CDC reports 4,907 cases have been confirmed in the United States as of Thursday, including 10 cases in Iowa. It can spread through direct contact, including with infected areas and body fluids, as well as prolonged face-to-face contact and activities such as kissing and sexual contact, according to the CDC. With low supply currently in the state's stores, Iowa is prioritizing people who have had an exposure to the virus for a vaccine. As the supply increases, the state may make the vaccine available to those who haven't been exposed, Carfrae said. Carfrae didn't specify which groups will be prioritized. While monkeypox isn't spread solely through sexual contact, the majority of cases have been among men who have had sex with men, according to early studies. Listeners, we would like to remind you that you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, August 1st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Alvy G. Kuhn, known as Bud, passed away Monday, July 25th, 2022, in Iowa Methodist in Des Moines, surrounded by his family. He is survived by his wife of 58 years, Janet Kent, his son Mike, spouse Nancy Kuhn of Kansas City, his daughter Susan, spouse Rob Short of Ankeny. Visitation will be from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock on Monday, August 1st, with funeral services following immediately after the visitation at Ankeny Funeral Home at 1501 West 1st Street, Ankeny, Iowa. Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek, died at age 89. This is a story filed by Lindsay Barr of the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of the woman we know as Lieutenant Uhura from Star Trek. Nichelle Nichols, who broke barriers for black women in Hollywood when she played communications officer Lieutenant Uhura on the original Star Trek television series, and she has died at the age of 89. Her son, Kyle Johnson, said Nichols died Saturday in Silver City, New Mexico. Quote, last night, my mother, Nichelle Nichols, succumbed to natural causes and passed away. Her light, however, like an ancient galaxy now being seen for the first time, will remain for us and the future generations to enjoy, learn from, and draw inspiration, Johnson wrote on her official Facebook page Sunday. Quote, hers was a life well lived and as such a model for us all, unquote. Her role in the 1966 through 1969 series as Lieutenant Uhura earned Nichols a lifelong position of honor with the series' rabid fans, known as Trekkies or Trekkers. It also earned her accolades for breaking stereotypes that had limited black women to acting roles as servants and included an interracial on-screen kiss with co-star William Shatner that was unheard of at the time. Quote, I shall have more to say about the trailblazing, incomparable Nichelle Nichols, who shared the bridge with us as Lieutenant Uhura of the USS Enterprise, and who passed away today at age 89. George Tacky wrote on Twitter, quote, for today, my heart is heavy, my eyes shining like the stars you now rest among, my dearest friend, unquote. Like other original cast members, Nichols also appeared in 6 big screen spinoffs, starting in 1979, with Star Trek The Motion Picture, and frequented Star Trek fan conventions. She also served for many years as a NASA recruiter, helping bring minorities and women into the astronaut corps. More recently, she had a recurring role on television's Heroes, playing the great aunt of a young boy with mystical powers. The original Star Trek premiered on NBC on September 8, 1966. Its multicultural, multiracial cast was creator Gene Roddenberry's message to viewers that in the far-off future, the 23rd century, human diversity would be fully accepted. Quote, I think many people took it into their hearts that what was being said on TV at that time was a reason to celebrate, Nichols said in 1992, when a Star Trek exhibit was on view at the Smithsonian Institute. She also recalled how Martin Luther King Jr. was a fan of the show and praised her role. She met him at a civil rights gathering in 1967, at a time when she had decided not to return for the show's second season. Quote, when I told him I was going to miss my co-stars and I was leaving the show, he became very serious and said, you cannot do that, she told the Tulsa, Oklahoma World in a 2008 interview. Quote, you've changed the face of television forever, and therefore you've changed the minds of people, she said the civil rights leader told her. Quote, that foresight Dr. King had was a lightning bolt in my life, Nichols said. During the show's third season, Nichols's character and Shatner's captain, James Kirk, shared what was described as the first interracial kiss to be broadcast on a U.S. television series. In the episode, Plato's Stepchildren, their characters who always maintained a platonic relationship, were forced into the kiss by aliens who were controlling their actions. The kiss suggested that there was a future where these issues were not such a big deal. Eric Deggans, a television critic for the National Public Radio, told the Associated Press in 2018. The characters themselves were not freaking out because a black woman was kissing a white man. In this utopian-like future, we solved this issue. We're beyond it. That was a wonderful message to send, unquote. Worried about the reaction from Southern television stations, showrunners wanted to film a second take of the scene where the kiss happened off-screen. But Nichols said in her book, quote, Beyond Uhura, Star Trek, and Other Memories, that she and Shatner deliberately flubbed a line to force the original take to be used. Despite concerns, The episode aired without blowback. In fact, it got the most fan mail that Paramount had ever gotten on Star Trek for one episode. Nichols said in a 2020 interview with the Archive of American Television. Born Grace Del Nichols in Robbins, Illinois, Nichols hated being called Gracie, which everyone insisted on. She said in a 2020 interview, when she was a teen, her mother told her she had wanted to name her Michelle, but thought she ought to have alliterative initials like Marilyn Monroe, whom Nichols loved, hence Nichelle. Nichols first worked professionally as a singer and dancer in Chicago at age 14, moving on to New York nightclubs and working for a time with the Duke Ellington and Lionel Hampton bands before coming to Hollywood for her film debut in the 1959 Porgy and Bess, the first of several small film and TV roles that led up to her Star Trek stardom. Now let's turn to the opinion section. This next is an editorial written by Michelle Goldberg, and she writes for the New York Times. The title is The Myth of the Good Trump Official. A central theme of the January 6th hearings has been Republican redemption. A parade of Republican witnesses has testified to being pushed beyond the limits of their loyalty to Donald Trump. For some, the breaking point came when he tried to enlist them in a scheme to overturn state elections. Others revolted at the former president's attempts to corrupt the Justice Department or at his role in inciting an insurrection. A rioter, awakened to Trump's lies, testified about being misled. In a poignant moment after the seventh hearing, he apologized to the Capitol Police. Republican Representative Liz Cheney, the January 6th committee's vice chair, had been perhaps its most prominent voice. At Thursday's primetime hearing, the last until September, she painted diehard believers in Trump's big lie as noble victims. Quote, Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened, said Cheney. Quote, they would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her, and he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our capital and our Constitution, unquote. It is a sign of the committee Democrats' love of the country that they have allowed the hearings to proceed this way. They are crafting a story about January 6th as a battle between Republican heroism and Republican villainy. It seems intended to create a permission structure for Trump supporters to move on without having to disavow everything they loved about his presidency or to admit that January 6th was the logical culmination of his sadistic politics. If you believe, as I do, that Trump's sociopathy makes him a unique threat to this country's future, it makes sense to try to lure Republicans away from him rather than damn them for their complicity. There is a difference, however, between a smart narrative and an accurate one. In truth, you can't cleave Trump and his most shameless anti-democratic enablers off from the rest of the Republican Party, because the party has been remade in his image. Plenty of ex-Trump officials have come off well in the hearings, including the former Deputy National Security Advisor, Matthew Pottinger, the former Acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, and, in video testimony, the former White House Counsel, Pat Cipollone. That shouldn't erase the ignominy of having served Trump in the first place. I have a lot of respect for Cheney, who is likely sacrificing her future in Republican politics in her attempt to hold Trump accountable, and for the bravery of witnesses like Cassidy Hutchinson, who testified despite the Trump camp's reported attempt to intimidate her. But whatever they say now, the witnesses who worked for Trump enabled his mounting authoritarianism. Each contributed in his or her own way, not just to January 6th, but also to eroding our democracy so that January 6th may be just a prequel. Each helped bring us to a point where, according to a recent survey, more than half of Americans believe a civil war will erupt in the United States in the near future. Quote, it was a privilege to serve in the White House, Pottinger said during his testimony on Thursday. Quote, I'm also very proud of President Trump's foreign policy achievements, unquote. Pottinger worked for the Trump administration from its beginning until January 7, 2021. He was one of many who didn't resign over Trump's defense of the rioters in Charlottesville, Virginia. His attempted extortion of President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, or his claims to have won an election he clearly lost, to cite just a few milestones. During Pottinger's testimony, he said that January 6th emboldened our enemies by helping give them the ammunition to feed a narrative that our system of government doesn't work, that the United States is in decline, unquote. But there's no way to separate that from the rest of Trump's legacy or from Pottinger's own. He shouldn't be proud. One of the few Trumpists who seem to have really reckoned with what she participated in is Stephanie Grisham, who is Trump's former press secretary, though she never held a news conference. Quote, I don't think I can rebrand. I think this will follow me forever, she told New York Magazine's Olivia Nuzzi last year. Quote, I believe that I was part of something unusually evil, unquote. They all were. Everyone who kept that catastrophic administration functioning at a minimum level while Trump built the cult of personality that made January 6th possible. It's important to remember their culpability because Trump is probably going to run for president again, and he could win. If he does, Republicans who like to think of themselves as good people, who don't want to spend their lives in the right-wing fever swamps, will be faced with the question of whether to serve him. They will see the former Trump officials who were able to rebrand despite sticking with him almost to the end, and they might think there's not much to lose. In his bracing book, quote, Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell, Tim Miller, a former Republican National Committee spokesman, tries to understand why friends and associates who once hated Trump eventually submitted to him. Quote, there were thousands of people who at some level complied with Trump, who weighed the cost, he wrote, who knew the dangers, who might have chosen a different path if they could have imagined a different, more fulfilling future for themselves. The January 6th committee is trying, against the suck of Trump's dark gravity, to point the way to such a future. To do that, it has been liberal with absolution. That doesn't mean absolution is deserved. The next editorial comes to us from the New York Times editorial board, and it is titled, Russia is making heaps of money from oil, but there is a way to stop that. The United States and its allies are leaning heavily on economic sanctions to punish Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. But a key element in that strategy, restrictions on Russian oil exports, mostly appears to be causing pain for ordinary people in other countries. European nations in particular are causing considerable damage to their own economies without reducing Russia's oil revenue. Nations seeking to help Ukraine are aiming at the wrong target. They have focused on reducing Russia's energy exports instead of reducing Russia's earnings from energy exports. Russia is exporting less oil, but in a perverse twist, it is earning more money, according to the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air, based in Finland. The sanctions have raised prices, more than offsetting the decline in exports. In May 2022, Russia earned 883 million euros per day from oil exports, up from 633 million euros per day in May of 2021. The situation is about to take a turn for the worse. New sanctions that the European Union and Britain have agreed to impose on Russia by year's end are likely to drive oil prices even higher. Some analysts warn that the price of a barrel of oil could exceed $200, well above the spike in the early weeks of the war, when oil prices topped out at about $124. That could easily push Western economies into a recession. The Biden administration has a plan that could avert this crisis. it would establish a buyer's cartel, an agreement among Russia's customers to put a price ceiling on Russian oil. That ceiling would be significantly lower than the current market price, sharply reducing the role of Western consumers in funding the Russian military. But the price would still allow Russia to make some profit so that it has an incentive to export its oil to members of the cartel. Some of the key participants in the plan, including the United States, have banned the importation of Russian oil, but other nations that America hopes to enlist, notably India, continue to import large volumes of Russian oil. It is an audacious and untested idea. It also appears to be the best available option. If it works, it could deprive Russia of revenue without devastating the economies of nations that are trying to support Ukraine. Constructing a cartel is not easy. The United States has already secured the agreement in principle of the other members of the Group of Seven, a coordinating body for the major democratic economic powers. American officials, including Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, are working with their counterparts to hammer out the details. The buyer's cartel would be strengthened if other big buyers of Russian oil, notably India and China, could be persuaded to participate. That seems unlikely. But U.S. officials argue the cartel could still increase pressure on Russia by allowing nations that are not participating to extract larger discounts too. Maintaining a cartel is also hard, because the participants can benefit by cheating on the price ceiling. Policing a price-fixing agreement is notoriously difficult, but in this case, there may be a plausible enforcement mechanism. A key piece of the new sanctions by the European Union and Britain is a ban on insuring tankers that carry Russian oil. Shippers need insurance to navigate canals and to enter harbors. European companies dominate the market. In April and May, 68% of Russian oil exports traveled on tankers insured by European businesses. That measure could be modified to ban insurance for tankers with oil purchased at a price above the cartel ceiling. The Russian government has sought to forestall the plan by warning that it would refuse to go along with it. Quote, "As far as I understand, we won't be supplying oil to those countries which would impose such a cap. And our oil products will be redirected to the countries which are ready to cooperate with us," unquote. Elvira Nebulina, the governor of Russia's central bank, said at a news conference last week. Analysts, however, say that if a cartel is established, Russia's real choice would be between accepting its terms and leaving a large share of current oil production in the ground. Perhaps the most compelling objection is that the price ceiling plan removes the stigma on Russian oil. Ukrainian leaders argue that the best way to aid their cause is to abstain from spending any money on Russian energy. A cartel would normalize those purchases. The world would surely be a better position today if it had not developed a dependence on Russian energy. That is a tale with its own lessons, including the urgency of transitioning to sustainable energy that can be generated closer to home, and the need to align trade policy more closely with other national priorities. The only lasting way to reduce Russia's economic power as an energy exporter is to reduce demand for its energy. But those shifts will take time. A buyer's cartel is a temporary expedient. After decades of complacent dependence on Russia, European nations are scrambling to adopt new plans to reduce energy use and expand sustainable wind and solar power. The war in Ukraine ought to catalyze similar investments by the United States, which is a net energy exporter, but remains dependent on fossil fuel imports. In the meantime, Ukraine needs the sustained support of its allies in what may be a prolonged struggle. It is counterproductive to impose unnecessary pain. Now we move back to local news from the Courier. Two more charged with money laundering in drug trafficking investigation. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. Two more people have been arrested for allegedly sending money to a drug trafficking organization in Mexico. Waterloo police arrested Samuel Roland Monroe, 33, and Raylene Diane Wenman, 24, both of Waterloo, on charges of money laundering. Bond for Wenman, who is facing four counts, was set at $80,000. Monroe was charged with two counts, and bond was set at $20,000. Authorities allege the two wired money by Western Union to Calican, Mexico, where a main operator with the Manjuarez drug trafficking operation was living in January, March, and April 2021. Transfers were usually in the $900 range, and investigators believe the money was the proceeds from drug sales, court records state. The organization was moving large amounts of methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl to the Waterloo area. Wenman was allegedly obtaining meth from one of the people in the organization and helping distribute the drugs, according to court records. Monroe was also obtaining meth from a person in the organization. Waterloo police earlier arrested three other people, Megan Haying, Richard Mahorn, and Mark Siles, on money laundering charges in the investigation. The next story was also filed by Jeff Reinitz. Update: standoff over in shooting investigation. And the story opens with a photograph of a policeman in uniform as he's part of this investigation. Dateline Waterloo. Police continue to investigate an early Sunday shooting that damaged at least two homes and led police to cordon off a block while they waited to search a house. Officers were called to a report of gunshots on Levitt Street around 5:40 a.m., and police found a hole in a window at 1208 Levitt and damage to siding at 1214 Levitt. Authorities turned their attention to a home at 1126 Levitt Street, and they were able to get a group of people to exit the home. Officers were concerned others were still inside, and the department's tactical team entered around 11 a.m. and found no one else at the house. Crime scene officers photographed damage to the homes and collected spent shell casings and bullets from the scene. No further information was immediately available on any charges. And now we turn to the sports page. The greatest champion, NBA legend, 11-time champ, Bill Russell dies at 88. Story was filed by the Associated Press. Dateline Boston. Bill Russell, the NBA great who anchored a Boston Celtics dynasty that won 11 championships in 13 years, the last two as the first black head coach in any major U.S. sport, and marched for civil rights with Martin Luther King Jr., died Sunday. He was 88. His family posted the news on social media, saying Russell died with his wife, Janine, by his side. The statement did not give the cause of death, but Russell was not well enough to present the NBA Finals MVP trophy in June due to a long illness. Quote, Bill's wife, Janine, and his many friends and family, thank you for keeping Bill in your prayers. Perhaps you'll relive one of two of the golden moments he gave us, or recall his trademark laugh as he delighted in explaining the real story behind those moments unfold, the family statement said. And we hope each of us can find a new way to act or speak up with Bill's uncompromising, dignified, and always constructive commitment to principle. That would be one last and lasting win for our beloved number six, unquote. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said in a statement that Russell was, quote, the greatest champion in all of team sports, unquote. Quote, Bill stood for something much bigger than sports, the values of equality, respect, and inclusion that he stamped into the DNA of our league. At the height of his athletic career, Bill advocated vigorously for civil rights and social justice, a legacy he passed down to generations of NBA players who followed in his footsteps, Silver said. Through the taunts, threats, and unthinkable adversity, Bill rose above it all and remained true to his belief that everyone deserves to be treated with dignity. a Hall of Famer, 5-time Most Valuable Player, and 12-time All-Star. Russell, in 1980, was voted the greatest player in the NBA history by Basketball Writers. He remains the sport's most prolific winner as a player in an archetype of selflessness who won with defense and rebounding while leaving the scoring to others. Often, that meant Wilt Chamberlain, the only player of the era who was a worthy rival for Russell. But Russell dominated in the only stat he cared about, 11 championships to 2. Off court, a champion for justice, the native of Louisiana also left a lasting mark as a black athlete in a city and country where race is often a flashpoint. He was at the March on Washington in 1963 when Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech, and he backed Muhammad Ali when the boxer was pilloried for refusing induction into the military draft. Quote, to be the greatest champion in your sport, to revolutionize the way the game is played, and to be a societal leader all at once seems unthinkable, but that is who Bill Russell was, the Boston Celtics said in a statement. In 2011, President Barack Obama awarded Russell the Medal of Freedom alongside Congressman John Lewis, billionaire investor Warren Buffett, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and baseball great Stan Musial. Quote, Bill Russell, the man, is someone who stood up for the rights and dignity of all men, Obama said at the ceremony. Quote, he marched with King, he stood by Ali. When a restaurant refused to serve the black Celtics, he refused to play in the scheduled game. He endured insults and vandalism, but he kept on focusing on making the teammates who he loved better players and made possible the success of so many who would follow, unquote. And that does it, listeners, for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, August 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.